Because it's true. If you don't feel emotionally safe and you don't feel connected and you don't feel that sense of belonging, it's really hard to, trust other people. And then from there, it's hard to learn.
Welcome to Schoolin' Around, a podcast hosted by Branching Minds featuring prominent leaders, subject matter experts, and thought innovators with their perspectives on the current challenges facing K-12 education. I'm your host, Larissa Napolitan, a former teacher, instructional coach, and a member of the Branching Minds team, here to lead conversations with educational leaders and experts. My hope is to share with you not only valuable insights and knowledge from leaders in education, but have fun while doing it and shine a light on phenomenal educators and those that are on a mission to transform our schools and the lives of students. Recent research around students' mental and emotional health has revealed a dire need for educational professionals to do something to help. More than 15% of students have had a depressive episode in this last year, and many parents believe their students would benefit from mental health assistance. Our guest today, Dr. Essie Sutton, an applied developmental psychologist, has made it her job to learn more about how social-emotional learning and mental health supports can actually help students. Dr. Sutton is the Director of Learning Sciences for Branching Minds and spends her time researching student outcomes and evidence-based practices for learning. In our conversation today, we talk about how teachers use evidence-based practices in the classroom, the need for deeper understanding around social-emotional learning, and all that she's learning from her work. Here's my conversation with Dr. Essie Sutton. So welcome, Dr. Essie Sutton, to our podcast today. We are excited to have you here. Dr. Sutton is our Director of Learning Sciences. She's got a PhD in Applied Developmental Psychology. Did I get that right?
Yes.
Essie, would you just mind telling us a little bit about how you, as a applied developmental psychologist, ended up working with this ed tech company? How did you end up here?
So I had worked with children, adolescents in a lot of different contexts. And from that, I really became interested in the social development of children, specifically around their social skills, which really led me to pursue studying psychology and then go on to do a master's in psychology and then a PhD in applied developmental psychology, which essentially means the study of children and adolescents in an applied context. And so in my case, I was really focused on school settings as that context. So during my program, one of my classes was on evaluation. And one of our assignments was to work with an organization or a company and develop a research evaluation proposal. How would we study essentially the impact or the outcomes of the program or practices that were being offered by that organization? And I was very interested in education technology at the time. I thought it was a really effective way to take what we were learning from the research and apply that to classrooms and schools. So I was always, looking around for different ed tech companies, and I came across Branching Minds, I think through Twitter. It stood out because it was in New York and I was living in New York at the time. And I thought what they had on their website was really interesting. So I reached out and I met with Eva Dundas, who is our chief product officer now. And they were really interested in putting together this research proposal. So that was kind of how I started working with Branching Minds. I through this course, put together this research proposal, and then I ended up actually doing the research study, which is one of our preliminary studies on the impact of Branching Minds implementation on students' reading and math achievement. Mm-hmm.
So kind of maybe going back a little further, like how do you get interested in applied developmental psychology? I guess it's not a degree I hear. I know there's people out there that do it, but it's not like something I was fully aware of. Like what, like how did you grow up wanting to be a psychologist? Like how did you end up sort of choosing this field?
You know, for me, it wasn't like I set out wanting to be an applied developmental psychologist, just like you. I didn't even know what it was. I mean, once you study psychology, you really do learn that there are so many different areas within psychology. Psychology is a very, very large field, similar to engineering. I mean, there's a lot of kind of sub areas within that. So it really came from the area of research that I was interested in, and also the professors and mentors that I worked with. So I became really interested in social emotional learning. I didn't really know that it was called social emotional learning, but I worked, and I also went to a summer camp that essentially did social emotional learning, but we didn't call it that. But it was really focused on creating these safe environments for children, safe both physically and also emotionally, creating these really strong connections, so that, you know, when you had this environment that was really safe and children felt good there and they had positive relationships with other kids and staff members, then all of this learning could take place. And I thought this was a really great approach, and I thought it was amazing. And I always wondered why this wasn't really done in schools, or at least it wasn't done in the schools that I went to. So from there, it kind of led me to, you know, other researchers that were looking at doing these types of studies or looking at these programs that they were trying to get into schools, similar to what we had been doing at the summer camp. And from there, I ended up working with a professor at the University of British Columbia who studied a specific program that I had kind of done some research on called the Roots of Empathy, which is a social emotional learning program where a mother and a new baby visit a classroom once a month for an entire school year. And there's also an instructor that comes along too. And the development of the baby and the baby's emotions and physical development is really used as a springboard for teaching other social emotional skills to children. It's a really awesome program.
Oh my gosh. That sounds like, I just am like, whoa, that that would be a very interesting, like, is it like what age, what kind of classroom were they visiting?
Just any classroom. Yeah. Okay. I think they do it kindergarten. I think they actually do it in pre-K now, all the way up to eighth grade. I don't know if they have a high school program, but yeah, it's a really amazing SEL program. I know it's used more commonly in Canada and United Kingdom and a little bit in the US as well, but
yeah,
it's really, really cool. So yeah, that's how I really got introduced to this area of social emotional learning in schools. And
I really loved how you described, you know, that experience at the summer camp, because I think that often, I mean, and we know right now SEL is such a maybe misunderstood concept. And so I really enjoyed that you kind of just tying it with how people learn. And I think that that is because I can see that as like, as a former teacher in my classroom, there's so much of what I did, you know, that was a little like, it was SEL, social emotional learning. I called it like life lessons with Miss Bear. That was my name at the time. And pretended I had a YouTube channel about it, but using that platform of like how kids learn is so closely to how they feel and their emotions. And there's so much that's attached with that. And so, that's really great. And that's a really cool summer camp.
Yeah. Yeah. It was great. And I was lucky enough to go there as a child and then eventually work there. And then when I was working there, I really learned kind of the behind the scenes, like how do we create these really supportive environments for mm-hmm. kids? Because it's true, if you don't feel emotionally safe and you don't feel connected and you don't feel that sense of belonging, it's really hard to, you know, trust other people. And then from there, it's hard to learn. So those are kind of, to me, those things that are really needed, those foundations that are needed in any kind of learning context.
Oh, I agree. I agree. And I think that there's something about trust, and I want to get back to that later, because I think that plays into, you know, as far as developing MTSS programs and making changes in schools. But I am curious about sort of, you know, now that you're the director of learning sciences within this company, how do you see this, your work as learning scientists, really important in the work of supporting educators?
Yeah, so I think it's very important. I think, you know, learning sciences as a whole is really about making sure that the practices and the approaches being used by educators are effective. Teachers, we all know teachers are extremely busy. Their time is valuable, and they really should be spending that time engaging in practices that are going to be impactful at the end of the day, really have some kind of impact on student learning. So for me, that's kind of the overarching importance, is, you know, making sure that we are studying things that are important for learning, and then figuring out how can we get these findings back to the educators where it's really going to be the most impactful.
Well, and I think learning science is often, I wouldn't have classified myself as a teacher as part learning scientist, you know, even though part of my work as an educator was to like do the work and really make sure my instructional practices were most effective. You know, that isn't, for my experience, that wasn't the way I was trained. And so I think that there is sometimes that misunderstanding with learning sciences. And so like, how do you think that it, like in your experiences, what have you seen of the misunderstandings of learning science?
Yeah, I think sometimes educators see the learning sciences as a whole as being something that is more complicated than it actually is. And when it comes down to it, what it really is kind of investigating and evaluating different educational practices. Some of these things are things that teachers are already doing in their classroom. It might not even be something new. It might just be something along the lines of, you know, this practice might be more effective if you do it with this group of students, or if you implement it in this way. So it's not kind of having teachers do something completely different from what they're used to doing most of the time. So and an example of that, so when I was in graduate school, I was trained in a classroom observational assessment. And as part of this larger research study that I worked on, we went around to hundreds of classrooms all over New York City, and we used this observational assessment to essentially assess and measure the quality of interactions that were taking place between teachers and students. And you have to be, there's an extensive training involved that goes into being a reliable observer for this assessment. And throughout the training, we were learning about all these concepts around interactional quality and, you know, teacher-student dialogues and feedback loops and communication. There's all these different concepts. And for me, I was like, wow, like this seems so complicated. Like, how are teachers doing this in the classroom? And these are all evidence-based practices. That's why we were evaluating them in the first place. And when we watched these videos, because you watch a lot of training videos, when you see the teachers actually implementing these practices, like, you're like, oh, okay, like that's what it looks like, that this looks like a regular classroom. Like these are all realistic things that teachers can be doing that are really not that complicated, and that they're things that a lot of teachers are already doing on a daily basis. So I think to me, that's an example of how something that can seem really complicated and scientific, and but it's in reality, in practice, it's just good teaching.
I wanted to follow up and ask about, you were talking about the feedback loop, right? Or just these different things. And I think that it isn't as complicated. And many teachers are, you know, if you're kind of naturally gifted in that teaching way, you kind of pick that up, or you over the years, like I think about proximity, right? Like proximity is a fantastic classroom management strategy, but also instructional strategy, because the closer you are to the students, like the more likely they're engaged in what they're learning. And so like, I think about that as, you know, when I was in undergrad and learning about these like teacher strategies, you had these, like maybe it was five or six things that they're like, okay, start, you know, you get feedback on whether you're doing that in the classroom, and you slowly over time, it just becomes this like natural thing that you do. Or in maybe giving feedback and interactions with students, like it becomes kind of second nature, where teachers maybe don't think about that's what they're doing, that's their part of their training. I mean, much like a doctor over time, you know, learns how to do certain things. But I do think there is that part with learning science where science and education and the generations of students we have now are different than what we had maybe 20, 30 years ago. And so science has changed, and like some of that research probably has changed. And that's where we have to like continue to learn. And I think that's where learning science often feels complicated, because we have to start to change and adapt. And do you find that is like in some of the research, like seeing shifts in how learning takes place and what's effective over time?
Yeah, I think it's so true. I think the students of today have somewhat different needs compared to students 10, 20 years ago. And it's a really good point that the learning science is always, I wouldn't say it's changing, but it's kind of like evolving. And research findings, they kind of like build on each other. It's not often the case where, you know, things get completely turned around, like this one thing that we've been doing for years is completely wrong, we need to change. It does happen, and you know, there are examples of that taking place where things are, unfortunately, where, you know, not evidence-based practices are being used. But for the most part, it's really about kind of the research building on itself and becoming more specific, learning more about, you know, the how certain things should be implemented for certain types of learners compared to others. So yeah, it's definitely evolving and adapting. And I do think that's something that educators need to be aware of. And it's just another component of teaching in today's world, where you have to be adaptable and recognize the fact that the things that you learn in your pre-service teacher training, it's a starting point. It's like a foundation. There are always going to be new things coming out. And I think that's the same for any field we're talking about. Doctors, you know, it's the same in medicine. You know, there's new research, new drugs that come out, and, you know, doctors need to do their work and figure out what these things are and how they apply to their practice. So yeah, I think that's definitely the case. I don't know if that answered your original.
No, it does. Well, because I was just thinking about how, like, with learning science, and I feel like, you know, I started teaching in kind of in 2009, 2010. And I feel like, you know, with the adoption of technology in the classroom, and I felt like it started to kind of speed up, where there's always something new. At first it didn't move as fast. And now there's like just more adapting that comes along. And I found that newer teachers coming out of college adapt and evolve quicker to some of those changes versus maybe those of us who weren't trained, you know, like, or just what you're used to. And I think that evolving is a good way to, to describe it, because it is always building on it of like, okay, well, we know that you know, this kind of method of learning works, but then, oh, now we can do it on a computer and that, you know, it speeds up the process, or we get data back quicker. And so we can change how we're teaching, you know, like, I think it's just a matter of learning to not necessarily adapt, but be agile. I heard someone use that word and I was like, describes very much how teaching is now, where it requires an agility to adjust to what you're encountering and what new science what's new research is showing. And I think that the fact that there's so much more educational research at the ready for educators is really helpful. So
yeah, I think technology is a really good example, because we're still really trying to learn and figure out what's the best way for technology to be implemented in learning. It definitely is important. It has a place in every classroom, but there are certain components of teaching and learning that it's not going to replace. So what is that balance between using a technology-based program or intervention or curriculum versus something that the teacher is going to implement? So I think that's a really one of the newer areas of research, and it's interesting to see kind of what direction that's going in. But yeah, I think that's a really good example of new ways that teachers need to adapt.
Oh, something you said there reminded me of a conversation. I think it was, you know, we had just gone one-to-one with iPads, and there was this big push because it was cheaper to buy eBooks for our English classrooms. And the big conversation was like, you know, this is great that the kids can have access to this, but like, you know, having a book in the experience of like having a book in your hand and writing things on paper, like there is, you know, research shows that writing things down, you know, is helpful. And so like, as a teacher, I always had this balance of like, okay, having technology is really great, but sometimes it can't replace that experience of, you know, writing things down and creating something with your hands. And it is such a balance now, especially after doing, you know, teaching the pandemic when everything was online, then to go back to the classroom and try to like, you know, it was easier to have all my assignments turned in this way, but sometimes having them write things down, I got better answers. Like they thought through what they were writing a little bit more, you know, like there's just different things where you have to consider. And I do think that takes research. And as a teacher, one of the best things I did was like learn how to kind of do my own action research of like what works better in this way and like apply it and change the way, you know, change my instructional practices based on what I knew worked for kids. And then also, because I was in grad school and I, you know, learned how to dig deep in different research findings. I learned how to read those like really long dissertations and research articles and find what I needed to know.
One of the things you learn in graduate school is how to read those research studies very quick, where to find the key pieces of information. So you can kind of get through as many as possible.
That comes in handy in my job a lot right now. Yeah. And I'm sure yours as well. And I feel like I always love hearing you talk about different research and different things, because I'm like, I know that's her job, is just like learn some of this information. So so back to kind of the social emotional learning. What do you think we could understand better about social emotional learning as educators?
Well, first off, I think that a lot of educators do recognize the value and importance of SEL. I think, you know, there are very few educators that are against it, at least that I've come into contact with. Maybe there are some, but I would say for the most part, they recognize it as being important. I would say, you know, one thing that I hear relatively often is that, you know, SEL is, it's seen as an extra thing that teachers have to do. So it's like, oh, we have to teach math and reading and writing, and now we also have to teach SEL. Like, it's this seen as this kind of added on subject area almost. And I think that there can be problems with viewing it in this way, and something that I see being, you know, how SEL is more commonly talked about is as this kind of these foundational skills. So it's not something different or separate, but it's really the foundation which allows learning in these other subject areas to happen. And to me, what's really important is the ability to integrate social emotional learning into all these different areas of learning and education in general, and not having it as this standalone or separate program or lesson or curriculum, but really think about the ways it can be integrated into learning. So it's not separate or an extra thing. Like, it is the thing that you're doing, or that's underlying all the learning that's taking place. And that can be really difficult for teachers, especially teachers that are really trained on delivering curriculum to students and programs to students. So I think it's tricky. And I do think the SEL programs and approaches that manage to help educators with this integration, like, to me, that's the next phase, or really the future of SEL, at least in my opinion.
Well, I agree with that, because like I said, you know, there were times, and I taught middle school. So I often would tell people my job description was teaching teenagers how to be human, kind of like, just this idea of like, hey, when someone hands you a paper, you don't just, you know, like, this is how you respond, of like, this is the night that, you know, or hey, when you don't get the grade that you wanted, like going over some of those life skills of like why working hard is really important, you know, or just things like that, where I would pause my lesson and like kind of, you know, sometimes it would be a soapbox. Sometimes it would just be of like, hey, like we don't treat people that way. Or like, that's not how do you be a good friend? You know, just things like that, that I, you know, and as an English teacher, it lended itself to social emotional things, where we'd have journal prompts where we would reflect and think, you know, but even I've seen it in math classes where math teachers really trying to reframe how students thought themselves as mathematicians, and like, I can do, and believing in themselves of like, you know, yes, this is hard, but I can try hard, and things like that. And I think those are the times I've seen it done well, but I can see how there are teachers that say, well, this is not my job to teach them this. I'm here to teach this. And some of it is because it feels like an extra thing, you know, and there's, you know, with all that it feels to be piled on as a teacher, it feels like, oh, well, now I'm a counselor. But I also just think like part of teaching is that ability to take your content and make it relevant to students' lives and to just life in general. And have that perspective. And that's hard for some people who maybe don't have that perspective in real life. Yeah. So I think that you're right. It is needed in the sense of like, how do we make this a part of what we do? In like a real way, not in a, like, I think it can be really hokey or like, you know, like really, forced way, you know? So,
yeah. Yeah, exactly. I think it can be really challenging, and it is, I think we can learn a lot from teachers that manage to do this in really effective ways and are really good at it. To me, that's kind of the starting point. I don't think it really starts with the researchers sitting down and developing a program. Like, there has to be some kind of input from these educators or these teachers that do have these skills or have managed to integrate social emotional skills into just their everyday practice, to a point where it's not something they have to, again, what we were talking about earlier, not something you have to think about, or, you know, it doesn't have to be part of a curriculum or program. It's just second nature to them.
Yeah. Well, and I think too, you know, because there's been pushback on social emotional learning, I think teachers sometimes feel, you know, hesitant to kind of go in that direction in their lessons. But I do think that there is, like what you talked about earlier, when there is a teaching of social emotional skills, or even develop or recognizing that that creates safety and trust, which enables students to learn better, like, and, you know, achieve the outcomes that we all want them to achieve. I think that there is needs to be a recognition of like, hey, like we have to create psychological safety for students mm-hmm. to be able to learn. And some of that has to deal with emotions and feelings and some of that development. And I think that that is, that is really key. And I think I wrote it down because I've heard, you know, there was a webinar that I attended yesterday and like, and we were talking about this, the idea that like developing trust and psychological safety for educators is really key in helping build, you know, an MTSS framework or make changes and new initiatives within a school system or in a district. And I think that recognition for teachers as well, requiring that psychological safety to stay in the profession and to stay and in, be able to do what they feel called to do. And so I think that that's just really key. Like I don't think we ever escape that as a human, like requiring that
psychological safety. Yeah, it's true. There's that other level to SEL, which is the social emotional support that's happening at the level of staff and educators. And it's just as important as teaching SEL to students is that, and it, you know, if you have a school that is dedicated to SEL and those types of expectations and interactions and the way that people treat each other and interact with each other, if you're expecting that of your students, but it's not supported at the level of the staff, you know, it's not going to have the same kind of impact. It really needs to be there at each level within the system. And you can tell from the way that teachers communicate and collaborate and the way that, you know, teachers interact with administrators, like it is obvious and kids pick up on it too. Kids can tell when there is, you know, tension or any kind of disrespect happening, like they notice it. So it really needs to be integrated at each level within mm-hmm. a school.
Yeah. Well, and I always think safe people make safe places, right? People who feel safe, you know, as teachers, like if I'm feel, you know, that trust and that psychological safety and supported and social emotionally, like it's so much easier to do that for students, you know,
yeah.
like, cause I can think of years where it's like, I was having a hard year or things that were happening and I was struggling and it was so my students picked up on that, right? It caused disarray in my classroom or it was really evident. I just didn't handle situations as well. You know, like I think that it's just recognizing that human aspect of every level is so important.
Yeah.
Like you said.
Yeah. There's a lot of research on teacher stress and burnout and teacher well-being and how that impacts students directly and indirectly. So it's really important.
Yeah. So, I mean, I could probably talk about that for a long time. Well, so the last question we asked, because most of us are, you know, whether educators in some aspect and people who do the work in education. And so I'm asking, what's your favorite school supply? I know it seems like a really random question, but
so I'm going to kind of give a very Canadian answer. I don't think these things exist outside of Canada, but I could be wrong. But growing up, we used these special kind of folders called Duotangs, which required you to use a three-hole punch. So everyone had to have their own little three-hole punch, and you would mm-hmm. Get those holes in the paper, and then you would put it into a duotang, which would kind of keep all of the papers really kind of flat and uniformed. And I was a very organized child. I liked having all of my folders, you know, color-coded by subject area. And so that was, yeah, I love those. I miss them. I want to buy some today and start using them again, because I don't know, my life felt super under control and organized. I don't know what that says about me as a person.
Well, it's like when you had an organized binder, like when I had an organized binder, and you know, I always felt like, okay, everything has its place. I feel more, you know,
the little tabs, little divider tabs.
I really appreciate that you gave an answer about your childhood, like something you loved. And I think I'm going to, from now on, ask people, like, when you were a kid, what was your favorite? Because I think that that is far more interesting than, like 4 out of 6 people have said post-it notes. So I'm kind of like, okay, well, I know post-it notes are a favorite of educators. So.
Unfortunately, I just don't use that many school supplies these days, except for like a pad of paper and a pen. Mm. But I don't know. Now I'm feeling like I got to go stock up on some fun folders.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today and for this conversation. I'm always eager to learn what you're finding out about in research and everything like that. So we appreciate it.
Yeah. Thanks for having me. This was fun.
Thanks for listening to Schoolin' Around, a podcast hosted by Branching Minds. And don't forget to subscribe to this podcast to hear all our future episodes. As well, if you're enjoying our content, would you do us a favor and rate and review our podcast on iTunes? This helps others find our podcast and let us know how much you love what we're creating. Branching Minds is an educational technology company using learning sciences and technology to help districts effectively personalize learning through MTSS. To learn more about us, check out our website, branchingminds.com, or follow us on Twitter, Facebook, or LinkedIn @branchingminds.